then let's not let the government point the finger at us and say it didn't work because you didn't want it to work or you didn't try hard enough. Let's make sure that when that does occur, that we can stand up and say we have done everything in our power to make it work, and it hasn't. And now you must change the policy, whatever it might be. And that was the only logical argument I could see to handle the people who were, and there were a lot, who were still very upset, who were taking a dog in the manger attitude and were doing everything in their power to undermine the situation. And they had to be stopped. It had to be. You couldn't let it go on. One of those on a wing or in a squadron could do an enormous amount of damage, and you had to stomp on it right from the way you go. And the way you did it was you heard about it, or you got into a discussion. I used to spend a lot of time around the wings, and particularly at the bar, where some of these things would come up. A lad would tee off, and I used to always, and even airmen would do it. I used to spend a lot of time with the airmen at their beer call on a Friday night, and I'd spend a couple of hours, and I wouldn't even start to talk for about an hour. I'd just wander around and let the lads listen to the boys. And invariably something would come up. And so then I would just stand up and talk to all of them and do it and say, well, I've heard this and I've heard that. And I just, here's what it is. And here's your attitude or here's your approach and whatever. But trying to explain to them, to bring them along. Not to hit them over the head, but to bring them along. And someone who dug his heels in on unification, you weren't going to change him by ordering him. You had to convince him that there was only one way to go, and that was to cooperate until the thing either fell flat in his face or it worked. Or, and this is what happened, or until policies were amended as circumstances changed or as lessons were learned. And this did occur. A lot of policies were changed, not in the basic principle or in their basic intent, but in the application. Because there were inequities or things, it wasn't going to work. So they were changed. But it never did arise that the whole principle of unification was not a viable operation. It was, and it is today. I'll tell a little story about that. No, I won't get into that one now because it occurred later. This is talking about the younger people, not the people who had been brought up and died in the world light blue or dark blue or khaki.
I remember at that time one of the things going on in Ottawa, the new unified salute.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. That's right. And of course, one of the things, I must just mention another little thing, too, on the uniform, about the green uniform. Some of the officers saying, I'm never going to wear that green uniform. That's terrible. Why should we ever have to wear a green uniform? And, boy, the blue is the uniform. Blue is the uniform. And I said, now, come on, what uniform do you wear in the summertime? And of course, we were still wearing the khaki uniform. And he said, khaki. And I said, oh, isn't khaki army? Oh, hadn't thought of that. And so, what difference does it make? You wear a blue summer uniform in the winter, you wear a khaki uniform in the summer, which is army. They're at least coming up with one that is a neutral shade. It's green. It's not blue and it's not khaki. Well, that would normally stop that argument or that approach to life. But it was... you had to use that kind of logic, I suppose, to bring people along.
Well, there was a great deal, too, of other stuff going on, as you say, not only the new uniform, the new rank badges, the new buttons, symbol. I mean, our Air Force at this time was about 40, 45 years old, and was ripping away a lot of the, as you say, the old traditions that people had worked under, fought under, grew up under, so to say.
Very much so.
And did you notice that, well, of course, you wouldn't, I suppose, in the Air Division, the fag in morale that occurred, certainly during the pandemic.
No.
It was, you could see it.
No. We were very lucky, and I was very lucky, because I was in the Air Division from the end of 65, very, what do you call it, 66, 67, 68, and I came back in 69. So during those very trying years, I personally was very fortunate. I was in the command, an operational command, a big role, an important role, nuclear weapons. Very, very few of the other services had been sent over, even in the logistics trades. We were beginning to get the odd army driver, vehicle mechanic, that sort of thing, but they were the exception. We were still pretty Simon pure air. So that it didn't, other than in from a talk point of view, and the more visible things, such as a uniform and the salute, and you're quite right, and the new buttons and that sort of thing, other than those, it was business as usual, as far as we were concerned. So our morale, the morale of the Air Division I can't say it wasn't affected. It must have been affected to a degree, but it was a very minor point. At this time, the wings were doing extremely well on these competitions I was telling you about. Yeah. Our recce wing was coming out on top, and of course, there's nothing like success, and it was just wonderful. So those were the important things to the boys at that time. It wasn't so much the uniform or that sort of thing.
What about the comments by other nations over there? I mean, what did the RAF people think when all of a sudden you would turn up with a green uniform and calling yourself a general or whatever?
Well, the RAF, they didn't have too much to say. Oh, there was the odd one who would take a jab, but
dig, yes.
But they were always the type of RAF person who I used to abhor anyway, and I knew several who, I used the phrase, look down their nose a few minutes ago. Well, these people really did, but they looked down their nose at everything. As a matter of fact, not only did they look down their nose, but they all went around all the time as if there was a bad smell under their nose. And the RAF had a habit of breeding some of those, as did the British Army. But they were in the minority. Again, my experience with the Brits and the Germans and with the Americans. But by the time somebody got up to that level, to a senior level, they had been screened and rescreened and rescreened, and they were very, very capable people. Always with an open mind and looking for ways to improve and that sort of thing, and not bigoted people. And now there were exceptions, but they were very much exceptions. And I mentioned the commander, I mentioned Air Chief Marshal Sir Augustus Walker. Well, Gus never once took any crack or anything like that. He would smile when he would refer to me as general. He would start to say Air Vice Marshal and then correct himself and say general, but he'd do it with a smile. Yeah. You know, it wasn't done in any derogatory way or like that. And, so it was perhaps a bit of teasing, but nothing. Yeah. Well, I guess maybe I could leave unification because it's a very, very broad subject, and somebody one of these days should sit down and write a book on unification. And I thought that Mike Pollard might have done it because he. He is a man who was in Ottawa during all of this terrible time. And he did resign, ultimately, not entirely because of unification, but unification had a very big part to play in his decision to resign his commission later on. So he, if anybody, was very close to unification, he was. And I had always hoped that Mike would write a book, but he, to my knowledge, he never has. Great shame, because God, he had first-hand knowledge, and not only that, but very strong opinions too. And Mike could probably quote example after example and example of problems and how they were tackled, how they were resolved, and how those resolutions, some were fair, some were unfair, some worked, and many didn't, and so forth. Whereas I can't, because I was too far away from it. I knew what was going on, but I wasn't involved in it, and it didn't affect me to any great extent. I sort of was on the receiving end of decisions, if I can put it that way.
Right, I can see that.
Any input I had, the papers would come out in the form of a draft, and we would send in our remarks and that sort of thing. But invariably, our remarks were always done as an airman, strictly as an airman, and our remarks, more often than not, were completely ignored in Ottawa. And then the decision would come out in the way of a policy, and we'd all curse and say, heck, they didn't pay any attention to what we said, but heck, we were one of several commands, and all with a biased opinion. Someone had to take all those biased opinions and make a decision, and this is what headquarters had to do.
What about Hedger himself? Presumably he must have paid you a visit.
No, he didn't. Not at that time. No, Hedger didn't. Not while I was in the Air Division. It was who took over from Hellier? Was it was it Catney? Oh, it was Catney before Hellier.
No, it would be Catney, I would think.
Was it Catney? I must try and remember.
Hang on.
I should get the I think that the business of unification of SAIC and drop, and perhaps you might get on to the other two and things now. One, the Manhart.
Yeah, I'm wondering about time here because I think we lost a fair amount of time on that.
Now, the Manpower one, I don't think will take too long.
Okay.
We perhaps can clear that one up. I suppose on any of these things, I could talk for a long, long time. I'm trying to give sort of the highlights of the thing, and at least for an indication of what transpired at the time, because any one of these things has got all there's a lot of background, a lot of detail, which I'm eliminating. Well, Manpower was the next major political issue. It was at this time that Pearson was the one who began the rot, and then, of course, it was Trudeau who really made it effective, and it was done by literally just cutting off the funds for the forces. One of the things that came out of unification was a great big trades review, and a whole new pay policy, which, for the first time, and it was a breakthrough, and perhaps this is one of the values of unification, for the first time, it was accepted that the people in the tradesmen and the services should be paid the equivalent of the people outside, which had not been the case up until then, far from it. A good technician, our attrition was terrible, particularly the Air Force and the electronics trades. Attrition was terrible because people were literally being offered jobs they couldn't refuse. And the pay increase was phenomenal. And yet they were going to be doing and carrying less responsibility in the new job than they were doing in the service. So one of the big things that did come out, and I maybe it was a sop to the services, but it certainly was long overdue to bring the pay of our people in line with that which was taking place outside. So pay was taking an ever-increasing bite of the annual budget, naturally, as these adjustments were being made. But at the same time, there was no increase in the budget. So the pressure was on to save manpower. And this was always hanging over our head. I think the thing that was the most difficult to handle and my greatest problem in the Air Division was always the demand from Ottawa for more manpower, or putting it around the other way, for me to reduce my establishment. And it was always, not always, but mainly without any reduction in our commitments. Until one time, when I received word that we were going to be cut back, we were going to lose two or three squadrons. I can't remember the figure now because I was so mad when I heard about it that I hit the roof. And I got onto Ottawa and I said, "My God, you want a lot of people. You're talking in terms of hundreds and hundreds of people in this cut." I said, "That's right. That's what we have to do." And I said, "All right, well, for crying out loud, tell me how many people you want and then let me tell you what I can do with the manpower that I have left. And it may not mean giving up the squadrons the way you want to do it. I might be able to keep the squadrons, but let me, I don't know at the moment, but let me know." And they said that no, they wouldn't, that I was going to be told what to do. And it just so happened that about that time, the minister came over on a visit. And I took the opportunity to really nail this point with the minister. I told him exactly how I felt. And he, bless him, this is one of those, I suppose, one of those few times when the minister really took something back. He went back and apparently told the chief that I was to be given the opportunity to do what I had asked, which was, tell me how much manpower I had to cough up and then let me sort it out from there. And well, I got word that was what I was to do. And I was to learn out later that I was very, very, very unpopular in Ottawa.
Yes, I was
of that action. Very unpopular. Because I had really cut right across all the chains of command and all that sort of nonsense. But this was so important that I felt that Ottawa, sitting in the ivory tower, someone had taken the establishments and had said, well, the easiest way to make the reductions is literally just to chop out units, which is not the way I felt. Well, having talked myself into this bloody position, now I had to produce. And of course, I had to produce in such a way that I was going to do what I said I could do, which was save squadrons and not lose units. And it was a big bite. If I remember correctly, my figure was something like 1,300 people I had to top up. And that was an enormous cutback in the Air Division, an enormous cutback. I was talking about sort of 20-25%. Well, I had all the wing commanders in, and the base commanders, I had their senior technical officers and their admin officers, and the base, what we call the Wing Co-ops. So I had the base commanders plus admin, technical, and operations from each of the wings here as well. And explained to them what the situation was, and we had a real problem. Then I said, and the only way we're going to get at this is that there were the three wings, because we still had Zweibrücken at that time in Germany. We had Zweibrücken, Lahr, and Baden-Solingen were the three wings we had. And then, the only way we're going to get at this is to divide up the work into the three major functions of ops, technical, and admin. And I made each one of the base commanders responsible for each one of those functions. And I said, I'm not going to do this in headquarters. I want you people in the field to head up the teams and tell me how we're going to find this manpower. And I don't want any nonsense. We've got to find the manpower. And I want you to tell me the easiest way to do it, or the way that's going to affect your operations the least. And go to it. Well, and of course, I had headquarters staff working on those committees, or if you like, those working groups. And boy, I gave them, I think I had something like 3 months to come up with the figures, with the solution. And so we set milestones, and I forget what it was now. Let's say at the end of the first month we had our first get-together. And as a result of that, it was obvious we were way short, kind of figure. And so I had to knock heads together again and say, you've got to get with it. And figure out ways of how we can find more manpower. Well, it was tough. It was extremely tough. And I always threw at them, of course, the other option. I said, the other one is we're going to fold squadrons. And, of course, that was the last thing they wanted. They felt the same way I did. That's right. Well, it was surprising. God, if we didn't wind up with the answers. Finally, we found all the manpower that was required by Ottawa. And we put our paper together, and I signed off on it. And I even took it over to Ottawa myself and took it in. Because we were up against the stops time-wise. And I wanted to make sure that that it was going to be acceptable. And, by God, it was accepted in Ottawa, so we managed to retain the squadrons, and we kept going. But what we had done, and this is where I'm going to just refer back to some of the things I had said earlier about the morale of the air division and how good they were, and how they did so well in these various competitions and what have you. And one of the reasons why they did so well is it shaped set certain standards. Some were time standards, there were various means of laying down standards. And, of course, our people were always knocking the living daylights out of these standards. For sometimes to say, take a time standard, they would beat the time standard by as much as 50%. Well, I held back on that one because this was operations, and I didn't want to cut into operations until I was absolutely convinced that we couldn't find another body in the administrative support. Oh, we cut down on our standards of cleaners. Any way that would cough up a manpower and would lower a standard. I lowered all those standards first. Maintenance, I had to be extremely careful. You could only go so far. The way we did that was, instead of doing an inspection, say, in 3 days, we accepted the fact that it was going to take 4 days to do an inspection. And so in that way, we reduced the manpower. It just meant that it took a little longer to do the thing. We didn't want to cut flying time, which was the other way of reducing your maintenance manpower, because the lower the hours, the less maintenance to do. So there was all this give and take. And another one was our bomb load crews. And our bomb load crews, God, they were so proud, and they were so good. And here was one case where we were knocking standards into a cocked hat. And I told the base commander who was in charge of operations, I said, all right, instead of doing as well as we are, we're going to have to go closer to the shape standard. Now, how many people can we toss up from our bomb load crews? Well, he almost went white when I said that. But it was the sort of thing we had to do. And we did. And it was by leaving the ops side to last that we were able to find all of the manpower that we were to cough up in the air division. And we did it by lowering our standards, except in those extremely important areas such as operations and maintenance, where there was no way you could do it. Perhaps I'm not being consistent there, or by working closer to the shape requirement rather than what we had set up as our own targets and our own requirements, which were completely out of this world in relation to the other nations in NATO. And it was pride. It was pride. And it was the pride that hurt when we coughed up those people, but not the operational capability of the air division, which was what I was worried about. And pride, of course, it soon melted, and I was delighted to find, God darn it, bless their cotton-picking hearts, that within, I suppose, a year, that those bomb-load crews were doing almost as well as they had done before, even with the fewer people that they had. They had said, all right, damn it, we can still do better than we're doing. Now, how do we go about it? Necessity is the mother of invention, and so forth. And they did. And it was wonderful. Just terrific. And then the net result was that it wasn't very long before we had already absorbed that loss. We found other things. That the troops were willing to do more of their own when it came to the housekeeping side than they had done before. But they knew. The whole air division knew the situation. I had to speak to the airmen in the air division. Every time I went out, this was such a big issue and a major issue, and then the morale could suffer if I felt that if it wasn't handled properly, or that's not quite right. If the troops didn't understand what the problem was, and it was very simple, they understood. They were just as keen about keeping squadrons as everyone else was. So they understood. And we got through that period really, with no reduction in morale. Pride was hit, but not the morale and the efficiency of the air division. So that was great. And the troops, truly, they just buckled to. We were able to cut back a wee bit in our security side by having more backup troops, which meant that the boys had to spend more time on base as opposed to with their families. In other words, they were working a longer work week in total. But they all accepted it. And they were just magnificent. I wouldn't describe it. Just magnificent. Well, we no sooner got through that hurdle than God, again, the next cut came along. And it was just one battle after another. And the next one, there was no way, having just gone through, and this would be about a year later, having gone through that one horrendous review, I knew damn well that any more cuts meant that we just simply couldn't do what we had done before. So, unfortunately, this one meant Zweibrücken, and so we had to close the base. That was the only way. We beefed up the squadrons, and we did more on the other two bases, but we had to close a base. And so Zweibrücken went down the drain as a base, and we then transferred everything to the other two bases. In other words, we doubled up on the other bases when it boiled down, but we saved all the manpower that was needed by keeping an operational base. Now, that was fraught with all kinds of problems. It meant that we now were concentrating much more of our operational capability on two bases. And therefore, we were in any kind of an attack, the dispersal of your troops, the shelters on the bases, everything was now much more concentrated, and therefore the risk was that higher. But that was one of those calculated risks you had to take. What was the risk of war in relation to what we were being pressured from Canada? It was better that than to fold up our tents completely and go back home. At least, so it was all a question of what are we willing to accept, what operational risks are we willing to accept, what happens to our position in Europe. All these many factors came to play. And we closed the air division. We closed the Zweibrücken. So the air division now had gone in a period of not very many years from four wings with 12 squadrons down to two wings and about six squadrons. And it was an enormous reduction. And that was not the end either, because just before I left, I've got to go back just a wee bit more. Before I'd even left Metz, the first indications of manpower cuts were showing up. And Ottawa was also concerned about the brigade group up in Germany. And would it be possible, through an amalgamation of some form, to save a lot of the overhead, which we had from the two major formations? There was no way the air division could move up to where the brigade was, because there were just no airfields in that area. None. Aside from that, it was much too close to the curtain. So it was really a matter of could the brigade group move down to our general area? And the initial studies were started before we left Metz in 67 on that one. And I had meetings with the brigade commander to discuss study teams and so forth. We did do some work on that. But that was the beginning of what was ultimately to happen and what became the next, third phase. Now, I did not personally get involved with that too much other than the initial planning, because the move of the brigade down to Lahr and the amalgamation of the two headquarters, that is, the brigade headquarters and the air division headquarters, into one Canadian overseas headquarters, took place after I left. But the work had started. The initial surveys had been done. I had to go through this whole business with the Oberbürgermeister of Laar, because it was obvious that it was going to come off. And where by this time the Oberbürgermeister had gotten used to Canadian airmen, he now felt that Canadian soldiers were going to be the end of the world, and their tanks, exactly, and all their tracked vehicles and so on. That was it. And he even sent some of his people up to northern Germany to find out how bad the Canadians were, and reported to me of some of the things that had gone wrong up and where the brigade group was and the fears of some of the Oberbürgermeisters in that area. And so it started, and I told him not to worry, that it would be exactly the same. And, well, again, I'm now going beyond my period in the Air Division, but they did have their trials and tribulations when they moved down. But that was then again the next cut. And so you can see that over a period of 3 years that I went through two horrendous reductions in trying to keep an operational front, and then the beginning of a third one. And by that time, I think by this time the morale was beginning to be affected, because the other decision, major decision, was the nuclear role, and I won't go into that one right now, but at the moment. But it also had shown up, and so of course now we were really taking the heart of the Air Division. Now, not taking anything away from our photo recce boys, far from it. They were good, and it was a role that was absolutely essential and required. We played a big part in SACOR's photo reconnaissance function. But really, from an airman's point of view, that bomb, the nuclear weapons, was really the whole being and the heart of air power. And air power is not meant to be a defensive thing. It is meant to be offensive if it's going to be effective, and if it is going to have an impact on policy. And here we were going to lose it. So
I think perhaps on the next time we can pick it up at that point, Ray. Yep. And I also want to get an idea from you about the relation of the Air Division with respect to overall command and control, if we can.
Yeah.
And
sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think I don't need to say anything more. As I say, I could go on for hours on this manpower problem, that it was always over my head, constantly over my head. And I cut my own headquarters down to just nothing, where I'd had a good planning headquarters, a good operational headquarters. As a result of all these reductions, I chopped and chopped and chopped and chopped until I had a headquarters that really I felt could probably operate for about 24 hours, and then we'd be out of business. Just no way we could carry on an extended war. We had to give up so much of our manpower, but it was done to keep the squadrons going. And as long as we were in the strike role, which, as I had said earlier on, was almost a one strike effort. It was a one time effort. If we recovered, wonderful. But we really felt that the chances of recovery would be pretty thin. So as long as we had that initial wallop, then it was worth it. Anything else we did perhaps was inconsequential. Somehow we would find a way of fumbling our way through when the event occurred. But we were always more, all of our thinking, all of our effort was directed to that first blow, that first launch. And as long as we got all those airplanes off in time, then the rest, God knows. We'd handle it when the time came. And that's right. As it came down, and we'd try to put it together and keep things going. So that this was the major issue. So even in my own headquarters, while we realized that we had now reduced ourselves to a point where, on an extended basis, we'd be in serious trouble, we rationalized that by saying, well, it probably won't happen anyway, in the sense that that after the 24-hour period, who knows what the hell's going to happen. We may not even be here. So I think that's enough on the manpower problem. Terrible, terrible time. And other commands were doing the same thing, but we felt it very badly. I was only thankful for that one, that I did get the ear of the minister that one time and was able to do what I had. Otherwise, we would have gone out of the business, I think, much sooner. And I'm not too sure I can't support this in any way, but I'm not, my feel is that the government really wanted the air division to get out of Europe. And what I was doing was I was tending to stall that whole thing.
A little bit like that French colonel on his face.
That's right, exactly. I was, by digging in, I think perhaps I was making it impossible for a government to say, we can't afford the manpower, or you can't do it within the manpower, within the money that's available, therefore fold it up and come home. I'm not too sure. It'll be one of these days, if Trudeau ever writes his memoirs, it will be interesting, or if he does, it'll be interesting to see what he really felt was the thing to do with our forces in Europe at that time. Whether he really did believe that we should come home. I think he did. I really do. I think he did.
Yeah. Okay. Right, well, we'll bash on later. This is an interview of Lieutenant General Lane by Dr. R. H. Roy at the University of Victoria on the 4th of December, 1978. Right, Reg.
By now, you've probably gathered that I feel very strongly about the nuclear role that the Air Division had, the importance of the targeting that we had, and the impact it had on our contribution to NATO, the fact that we were carrying all those targets, and the fact that the Air Division was so very good, far outweighed the actual numbers of our contribution to Europe. It was a very weighted contribution because of the targeting, and Thackeray's knowledge that if anybody was going to get through to these targets, it would be the Air Division, and hence that was why he had allocated his primary targets to us. So I felt very strongly about the role and about policy, nuclear policy. Therefore, I was more than somewhat chagrined when Pearson said that, as he did when he was the one who got us into the nuclear role. But he also, at the same time, said that he would negotiate us out as soon as possible. He said that all in the same breath, so that we were in with one hand, but it was a very, very much qualified acceptance of the role. And therefore, when I got to the Air Division and became, of course, very engrossed in that role and saw what it all meant, in the back of my mind all the time was concern about this negotiating out. And sure as God made little apples, it began to show up. Whether Pearson really, perhaps he was the pacifist that really believed that the nuclear role, nuclear weapons were just so dirty that Canada should not handle such weapons, should not be tarred with the brush of nuclear, the whole field of nuclear effort, or whether he just really felt that in his own heart, being the real pacifist, that he would like to be a peaceable man and do whatever he could to make it look as in the eyes of the world as if Canada was disarming. I've never really been able to grasp the fine points of Pearson's position, but it did come about. And the other aspect, too, is that I wondered, and I have often wondered, whether how badly or how he was influenced by the NDP position, because there is no doubt that the NDP were not only against nuclear weapons, but they were against NATO, Canada's contribution to NATO in total, and therefore they just didn't want any part of any of the nuclear weapons particularly, and therefore took every opportunity to chastise the government and advocate, of course, withdrawal from that particular role. This was brought home to me very forcibly when we had, as we did every year, had groups of parliamentarians come over to the Air Division. Mm-hmm. They were all fascinated by the nuclear weapon bit. Mm-hmm. And I remember when Lewis, then the leader of the NDP, he came over with one group, and as always, we gave them the briefing, and it was a completely unbiased in the briefing. It was purely a military briefing. We didn't let any political overtones get into it in any way. All we did try to do was stress the importance of the role. But we were hindered enormously by security. I could never at that time say that we were carrying Thackeray's target. Yeah. That was a very highly classified piece of information. So We just simply had to do it on the basis that we were good. Here's, we were carrying extremely important targets. I couldn't say what they were, naturally, or how they had been selected. I couldn't even infer what they were, except I had to keep saying that they were tactical targets. Because, of course, all I would have had to do was mention the word strategic, and my God, I think even Pearson would have flipped. But it was the importance that we tried to get across to, if it was possible, to change the NDP thinking on the Canada's position in NATO. And I hammered the point that our contribution was far outweighed the size of our contribution, in other words, the role. And I remember that one time with Lewis, after this particular visit, and we had a dinner in the mess that night for them, of these MPs, and I thought, I'd better see if I could beard Lewis. And got him into a corner, and we sat down, and I have never in my life argued with such a slippery person as Lewis. He has that legal mind, the lawyer's approach to life, and as soon as you think you've got him cornered, he slips out like that slippery eel. And it was frustrating as could be. Anytime I thought I was making a point, he would immediately ask a question, which was a divergent type of question, and we were often racing down another slippery slope. And it was frightful. And I finally, after about half an hour, I was really mad. I was furious, because he wouldn't admit to a single thing, and always would avoid committing himself by escaping out from under with another one of these slippery questions, and side-slipping, so to speak, away from the point being discussed. Very slippery. And I finally said to him, I said, "Mr. Lewis, it is quite obvious that I am having absolutely making no impression on you whatsoever, and I think maybe we'd better just drop it." And he said, "I agree." With that, I walked away from him. I could have hit him, I must admit. I was so mad. But it was typical of the type of thinking that was very hard-nosed thinking, but very biased, and would not listen to any other kind of rationale at all. It could was a frequency.
Could he not see any danger?
To whom?
Could he not see the danger presented by the Soviets?
Oh, no way. No. That the threat was overplayed by the intelligence community, that the threat was nothing like was being put forward. And as a matter of fact, he was not alone there. There were other MPs who came back from their, when they went to SHAPE, where they had been briefed at the highest level, not by us at the Air Division, who came back and publicly said that the intelligence was biased, that it was a hard sell, and they couldn't believe all that they had been told. That kind of thing. And this made it extremely difficult. As always, the trouble with intelligence is that it's highly classified. And you can only say so much. And the number of times with press, with the MPs, senators who came over to the Air Division, the number of times I just wished I could have taken them right into the intelligence section and shown them the information that we had. But I couldn't. And it was almost essential that I do it to make my point, to drive my point home. It's all very well to stand up and say, "Gentlemen, you've got to accept me, what I say, as God's truth." But they're not about to do that.
Especially MPs.
MPs. And you've got to be able to drive it home to them. And that's not the easiest thing in the world to do. Well, of course, the government began to make noises about withdrawing the nuclear role. And again, every time the minister came over, I hammered, and every time I had the chance for a press interview from that moment on, I hammered the nuclear role, what we were doing, the part that we were playing in NATO, the importance of our contribution in this particular role, that it was effective, that we were, and it was the only way where we were playing a very obvious part in the whole strategy of deterrence. We were a part of that deterrent role. not in a defensive role, in a purely defensive role, but in a semi-offensive role. I don't mean in a strategic sense, but you can't have nuclear weapons around and not call them very effective weapons. You carry an enormous punch. So it was a direct contribution to nuclear deterrence. But the decision had been made, obviously, and then Trudeau came in, and then we were on that slippery road, which kept, I could see it coming. And I was in the Air Division, and when I left the Air Division, I went to Montreal, so I was in no position to have any direct impact on any decision-making in Ottawa, other than my screams and my clawing and the letters I wrote and what have you, advocating retention of the nuclear role. But I was really a voice in the wilderness.
Well, were you the... Who would be the senior man, the senior Canadian overseas? Who was senior to you? What?
No, I was the senior Canadian in Europe in the sense of Canada's direct military contribution. We did have a senior position at SHAPE. Bill McBrien was a three-star at SHAPE for a while. I forget who came along after that. There were a few others who came along, but they were at the deputy chief of staff level at SHAPE headquarters and were therefore directly involved with SHAPE policy. They did not get in that direct channel of command or chain of command as I did with Ottawa. They never spoke directly to Ottawa. They had the opportunity to speak to the chief or the chairman when they came over, the minister when they came over to the various conferences at SHAPE, and there were several of those annually. They would have the opportunity to make their views known, but they were never in a position to write an official letter that would go through the chain. Because they were devoid of any direct link. As such, their loyalty was to SHAPE. And the commander, a Sakura himself.
Well,
not a political chain.
I suppose what I really have in mind, Reg, is that where and through whom would you get authority to use nuclear weapons?
Oh, well, the chain of command, of course, for the release of nuclear weapons was and still is the requires the authority of the President of the United States.
Right.
Number one.
Right.
Number two, Sakura is that wears two hats. That's why he's always an American. He wears two hats because he's not only SACUR for NATO purposes, but he's also commander-in-chief of American forces in Europe and has direct control over all nuclear weapons in Europe. That is, excluding the French, I'm talking about the weapons that NATO uses. And therefore, the chain of command or chain of authority for release of nuclear weapons is from SACUR to the commander-in-chief of American forces in Europe, who just happens to be SACUR. Then he releases it down an American-controlled net, communications net, to American officers. And you'll recall I said that there were Americans on all of our nuclear bases who actually controlled the storage of the nuclear weapons. So the chain of command was right down an American net, right down to the base where the nuclear weapons were located.
Okay, fine. Well, you get that. But from whom did you get authority to use the damn
hat? I got mine from Sakura, now wearing a NATO hat, not wearing his American hat, and he would get his authority to use nuclear weapons from the Council of Ministers. Remember at NATO. NATO has a Council of Ministers. And they would give SACUR the authority to use nuclear weapons. But he would actually, the release, that's operational use, the release of the weapons for operational use would come from the President of the United States. So you really have two controls, if you will. The ministers, NATO ministers always, and it was a great political issue, they wanted control of the operational use of nuclear weapons. And I think they still have it. It's not quite different to the authority to release nuclear weapons. The authority to release, meaning to release them to the Allies. The authority to operationally use them was still controlled by SACUR and through the Council of Ministers. So there are two chains of command here, but you had to have both before you could actually get a release. Now, I didn't have any direct... I didn't have to wait for Ottawa to give me a green light. Because We would have representation, either through the Council of Ministers or through our ambassador, who would speak at NATO. Our ambassador to NATO, who would represent the Canadian government. And when the decision, when the question of nuclear weapons came up, they would make the decision for SACUR. Yes, go ahead and use them. So it was Ottawa. Ottawa got its 2 cents worth in through either having a minister available or through our ambassador to NATO, who would represent the government in that kind of a decision. Right. And then I would get it through SACUR.
Okay, I'll flip over the tape because it's just on its last legs.